Hi, everyone. Welcome to the panel, Different Approaches to Reporting on Indigenous Issues, organized by CADR's News Collective. It is being held live on Zoom, as well as being broadcasted live on CADR 101.9 FM Vancouver, which is the traditional, ancestral, and unceded land of the Hunkaminim-speaking Musqueam people. We want to honor people's time, and so we're going to start right away. Just give me a thumbs up if you can hear me okay. Okay, sweet. Thank you so much for tuning in, whether you're listening to us on radio or joining us here on Zoom. I am so excited to welcome you all to this event. I am Henna, and I'll be moderating the panel tonight. I am the spoken word coordinator at CADR, UBC's campus and community radio station, as well as host of the show, This Is Not Fine, also on CADR. I am joined in studio by Trish.
Yeah, hi, I'm Trish. I am a fourth year student at UBC, and I am the News Collective coordinator at CITR, and the News Collective hosts a weekly show called Against the Current.
Lovely. I'll do the land honoring now. As I mentioned earlier, this panel is taking place on the unceded, meaning stolen, ancestral and traditional lands of the Hunkaminim-speaking Musqueam people. Media practices are often rooted in white gaze and colonial narratives. To be truly ethical in our journalism, we need to be actively rethinking. To be truly ethical in our journalism, we need to be actively rethinking and decolonizing media practices, as well as shifting our approach by moving towards radical empathy and anti-racist lens and supporting Indigenous sovereignty. While CADR 101.9 FM broadcasts from UBC Vancouver campus, our listenership extends to the unceded lands of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations and beyond. We encourage you to check out native-land.ca to learn more about whose land and territory you live and work on or may be visiting. The link is in the chat. Now, I'll pass it on to Trish to introduce the panel and our wonderful panelists for tonight.
Yeah, thanks, Anna. First, I want to welcome you again to our event, Different Approaches to Reporting on Indigenous Issues. Thank you all for joining us today on Zoom, and thank you to all our listeners who are currently tuning in to CITR 101.9 FM. I'm incredibly honored to be hosting this panel tonight with Henna and discussing this crucial topic of looking at various approaches to reporting on Indigenous issues. In Vancouver and in so-called Canada, representation of Indigenous issues and peoples in the news has been extremely problematic for a very long time. The harmful representation has been contested many times by Indigenous communities time and again. The media and the mainstream news channels often fail to provide context to many of the Indigenous issues that have roots in colonization and white supremacy. Moreover, due to the decontextualized reporting, many of the extremely complex Indigenous issues often end up being discussed and delivered in a binary us versus them tone. Additionally, there's heavy stereotyping and conflation of diverse Indigenous identities into Native or Aboriginal. As a result, it is vital to explore the topic of how to report on Indigenous issues with empathy and care. Also, due to the emergence of social media and storytelling in new media, we are presented with various ways to consume news and events in the 21st century. It is important to explore these newly developed realms where people with lived experiences are telling stories from their communities as well, to see how social media platforms and storytelling can be utilized to report on Indigenous issues and raise awareness. So that is why the News Collective at CITR is bringing you today's panel, where our panelists will be sharing their invaluable experience, knowledge, and insights about Indigenous issues and the way they present these issues through their work. We will be introducing our panelists shortly. However, first, a quick summary of the event. After the introduction of our panelists, I will pass it off to Henna to start us off with the discussion with our panelists. The moderated discussion will last for 50 to 55 minutes, and after that, we will receive and discuss any questions that our attendees might have. And I will provide the link for the Slido in the Zoom chat. So feel free to send any questions that you might have during or after the discussion through that link. Lastly, we will end with some closing remarks and hear any final thoughts from the speakers. Finally, I'm very excited to be presenting our panelists for the night. First, we have Jerome Turner. Jerome Turner is of Gixson and Swedish descent. He's a journalist specialized in coverage of national and provincial issues with a specific focus on Indigenous peoples. His coverage behind the police lines on Wet'suwet'en land defenders in 2020 for Ricochet Media earned him the Canadian Association of Journalists' highest honor, the Charles Barry Award, formerly called the President's Award. Next, we have Daley Nicol. Daley is a member of Wet'suwet'en Nation and runs the account Wet'suwet'en Checkpoint on Instagram and focuses on organizing grassroots movements through social media. She has been an activist and advocate for missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and True Spirit people issues through labor organizations for over a decade. She has also campaigned for protecting traditional hunting and fishing practices. Additionally, she has presented at the United Nations in 2019, condemning the planned man camps in Wet'suwet'en territory. Last but not least, we have Nicholas Creer. Nicholas is an adoptee of Cree heritage. He is a freelance journalist, writer, as well as an overdose responder and outreach worker. Currently, he is the storytelling and community networking liaison at Megaphone Magazine and manages a community writing collaboration column in the monthly print edition of the magazine called The Question Is. Moreover, Nicholas also sits on the advisory committee for the UBC Transformative Health and Justice Research Cluster that has co-authored Research 101, a manifesto for ethical research in Downtown Eastside. Recently, he also hosted Voices of the Street podcast, which is a 6-part series where the guests delve into the realm of audio storytelling.
Oh my god.
I will pass it off to Hannah now to get started with the questions.
Thank you. Thanks for those great introductions. I am very excited. I have a lot of questions, especially since we've got such a diverse panel, and I think that's so cool. And yeah, let's get right into it. My first question is, what are some of the things that the media still gets wrong when reporting on Indigenous issues? And I wanted to start with Jerome first.
Oh, hey. Sorry, yeah, my video, it kept cutting out, so I just opted to go without video.
Yeah, that's
so
okay.
I can stay connected. That's a pretty big big topic, really. Mainly, I don't think any of it is intentional. I just think, like, media just has no time these days to do a lot of investigative work, I guess. I think a given reporter, doesn't matter how much experience they have, if they're going into an issue like Wet'suwet'en or say Fairy Creek without any knowledge of Indigenous, the reality of the Indigenous people, where they're going, it's basically not a recipe for like the accuracy that's required. And that's not really a criticism of the people and reporters, and like getting as many stories out as possible about a given issue is extremely important. But I just think, yeah, the knowledge base of Canada in general, and then journalists that go to school and graduate and then get jobs is lacking. So I think that's where it starts.
Mm-hmm. And I want to ask you, Daley, about this.
Well, I would love to be as optimistic as Jerome and say that I don't think that it's intentional, but I think it's very much intentional that so many media outlets or mainstream media get so many things wrong, improperly report or put out information that's lacking full context. And I think that, for some of the larger media outlets, it's intentional because they're owned by people that have links and ties to resource extraction or, these profitable corporations and companies that operate on, the premise of land theft, and they need that, and they need to be able to somehow vilify possibly, or sometimes minimize Indigenous, the knowledge that's shared about Indigenous people and the background of everything, in order to justify a lot of resource extraction and, extractive industries, continued land theft, all of those things. And I mean, there's these like billionaires, that own most of the media outlets. And thankfully there are, smaller media outlets that are willing and able to put out proper reporting and accurate information. Such as the ones that mm-hmm. Nicholas and Jerome, report for.
For sure. And I'll pass it on to you, Nicholas. You're muted. Okay. Nicholas, you're muted?
Sorry. Yeah, like Jerome said, this is a major, major topic. And mm-hmm. the contexts are multiple. Well, actually, just two contexts, really. There's mainstream media reporting about Indigenous issues, and then there's Indigenous people reporting about ourselves on these issues. And the voice of that context will vary from outlet to outlet with the media. But the contextualized version of it only goes so far. As opposed to living it, right? As opposed to like being in the issues yourself and reporting on them, it kind of dissolves the idea of objectivity, right? Whereas mainstream media is in Western culture anyways, primarily based on this idea of being separated from the story and not being part of it. And you can just report the facts and whatnot. And then of course Canada's got just a long history of not knowing, right? Of basic ignorance about Indigenous issues. And we've only really started coming around to it in the last 20, 30 years. 20 years ago, I was working at Aboriginal Times in Calgary. And that, at the time, was Canada's only national Aboriginal magazine. And it was business, news, and that's about it. And just a small little paper, but we've come really a long way since then. So I try not to look at it as much as what they're getting wrong, as what can I do to support what they get right.
Thank you. That was definitely a very big question to start with, but thank you so much for answering that. And I am going to move on to the next question, which this question I'm really curious about, reporting and just generally my observation with how reporting is being done these days. Reporting and distributing information has gone through significant changes and is much more of a democratic process now. It can look like so many different things, as reflected on this panel. And there are various mediums now. We have blogs and podcasts and Instagram and Twitter. So in your practice, how has reporting evolved in the past couple of years, especially during the pandemic? And I wanted to start with Delhi.
Well, like, I think just speaking from my own mm-hmm. experience, seeing so much more information, the dissemination of information going out through social media outlets and through personal perspectives has been incredibly important. And really, I think changed the way that, the people, the general public, view Indigenous people, because there is more of a personal connection there then. And people get to share, first person perspectives, I think, and that's incredibly important, because you can talk all you want about facts and figures, and it doesn't necessarily affect people in the same way, though, as when, you know, you're able to personalize things and write or share information from the heart.
Yeah, I just want to give a shout out to your Instagram page, Deli What's Wooden Checkpoint. I definitely learn a lot from it, and I know my friends and my circle, I see people share news from that source before even mainstream media covers it, and that's very powerful. And
thank you.
I want to, yeah, and Nicholas, maybe you can talk about the podcast a little bit that you did last year with Megaphone magazine.
Sure. I think Julia said that they were sort of thinking about doing a podcast even before the pandemic. So Megaphone is a social enterprise that works. We're just a small team of six staff members, and we produce the magazine and Hope and Shadows calendar, and then a literary anthology that comes out every year. So those, and then we have a speakers bureau that does public speaking workshops around stigma against drug use, etc. That's in its fourth year now. And then last year they decided to branch out into this other medium of podcasting. So they had the Vancity Office of Community Engagement was funding us, and they brought in some professionals and students from SFU to train us in how to produce and write our own podcasts, and everything from the script to the sound effects and whatnot. They covered all of it, and then they went away and produced it at their studios or whatever, and then sent it back to us, and we released it on the website. And it's on the SoundCloud and the Below the Radar podcast, I think it's the name of the show that they have it on, and you can also find it on our website. And there's four of us from Megaphone, most of us on the Speakers Bureau, so we'd already had experience with public speaking and whatnot, and we were asked to pick a piece from the anthology and talk about it, the Voice of the Street anthology last year. And so I chose my own poem, actually, just because I like it or whatever. And then my two episodes, or one is an interview with myself in character about that poem. I didn't, because I showed up the day of, and the day of to do the interview with my other friend there, Eve, and she was doing it with Angel. She decided to do that interview with Angel that day. So I was like, okay, that's okay. I'll figure something out. And then I was like, what am I going to do? Like, oh, wait, I have a character that I wrote for a play who happens to be a podcast host. Maybe I'll just use him and I'll interview myself. So that's what I did. I interviewed myself in character as Mr. Sancho, this podcast host I did in a less than space. And then I had to modulate the voice a little bit so it would sound like two people. Mm-hmm. And it came off all right, I guess.
Yeah, it definitely did. For folks who haven't, the podcast is called Voices on the Street, I believe, out of Megaphone. And what I love about it is very experimental, and you folks definitely experimented and sort of played around with different soundscapes and different voices, like you mentioned, which is so cool.
Yeah, I didn't get a chance to get into the indigenous issues really.
I'm on the bike right now.
Yeah, that's okay. There, I have more questions. And I'll pass it on to you, Jerome, if you have any thoughts.
Yeah, I don't really deal with Instagram or any of those mm-hmm. kind of newer social media things. I sort of stick to Twitter, and I used to be fairly active on Facebook personally, but I kind of went away from it and mainly stick to Twitter these days. And with the way people interact, I know like Twitter can be a very toxic place to to be, but for me it shows me what people think and feel. I know there are lots of false accounts and stuff, but there are several accounts and people that are active on there that they're real people, and they're sharing their real feelings. Mm-hmm. And it just gives kind of a pulse to what's happening in these places and places where Indigenous people are, like Delise said, being robbed of their territories on a daily basis. So for me, it's an opportunity to actually speak directly to people who have wildly inaccurate views, and it's not always gonna go well, but I think it has the potential, if people give it the time that is necessary and remain as civil as possible. You know, like there are some things that people share that they're just way out of bounds, and I'll just stop engaging at that point. But
for absolutely,
it's a really big opportunity of space to be able to talk with people who you don't agree with, and specifically correct information. And I don't know, I do that for free a lot.
I bet all of you do. Speaking of different mediums, Jerome, I wanted to ask you, I know when you were covering the Wet'suwet'en protests in 2020 for Ricochet Media, you were making a lot of short videos and like uploading them. And how was that like?
That wasn't really intentional. We didn't think about doing that going in, but it kind of just it was possible because there was Wi-Fi out there, and because I was able to, like, I was permitted by Frida, et cetera, and Molly to be able to have access to it. So it made it possible for me to be able to share what was happening on the ground in the moment. And I think I'm hoping that it reached people in a good way. And like, I think it's really important that people are able to see it, because it, especially in a place like the Wet'suwet'en, like the Gidimden checkpoint and the Unist'ot'en Healing Lodge, like it's not a really accessible place. And especially when police put up a no-go zone for most media and public, especially, it becomes a place that is inaccessible, and it's really important for people to be able to actually see what's happening out there.
Thank you for sharing that, all of you. For my next question, and this is something Nicholas briefly mentioned, the notion of objectivity and how it's a myth, and so a lot of rooms are, a lot of newsrooms are moving away from the limiting notion of objectivity, since it only serves the status quo, and it's good to see that more and more people are talking about this. And so I wanted to ask the three of you, where you're in a unique position of being working in media and also being activists. I don't know if you folks like to call yourself that, or doing advocacy work. And I just wanted to ask you, like, how's that experience like? And like, how do you navigate it is what I'm trying to ask you. And are they the same thing for you? Because we also hear, again, the notion of objectivity, and I'm doing air quotes, of you have to separate that. So are they the same thing for you, or do you feel the need to separate? I'm just curious to pick your brain here, and maybe we can start with Delhi again.
I wouldn't call myself, I know I've referred to myself before as like an activist, but it is advocacy work, and it's something that, you know, we don't really have much of a choice in, if you to be able to share, you know, real perspectives and real life experience. It's just a part of, you know, who we are, and being given the voice and, you know, the ability to be able to speak out about things is our responsibility. And I think that, I don't know. It's definitely, I don't, I don't separate myself. I don't consider myself a media person per se. I've had like media training through labor organizations and like fairly extensive training, but I don't, I'm a single person sharing, you know, my perspectives, my ideas. Totally. And so it's not, I don't have the same experiences probably that Nicholas and Jerome have in working for other people. Mm-hmm. And having to be very cognizant of that. I'm very cognizant of sharing perspectives, you know, and not overstepping bounds. I always have to keep in mind my community, mm-hmm. my nation, you know, so those are the only people that I really have to mm-hmm. answer to.
Yeah. And I'm going to ask you the same question, Jerome.
Yeah, see if the video thing comes up. Yeah, definitely. I don't know. Like, I don't consider myself an activist either. Mm-hmm. I'm Gitsan. My people have been a neighbor with these people, the Wet'suwet'en, forever. And we share very similar structures and in government and laws that go back thousands of years.
Oh, I think we lost Jerome.
We did.
So I am going to go to you, Nicholas, till we wait for Jerome to come back.
Yeah, sure. I guess the idea of
Dr. Oh, Nick. Okay. Jerome is back.
Okay, Jerome. Okay.
Sorry. Yeah, the video thing didn't work out.
Yeah, that's okay. It's okay. We can hear you fine. So, yeah, if you just want to continue.
Am I okay to go, Nick?
Yeah, you can carry on.
Yeah. All right. So being called an activist by whoever would call me that is very, it's completely wrong in my, mm-hmm. if you're directing that at me, because I, like, even calling the Wet'suwet'en protesters on their own territory, or my Gitsan chiefs protesters on our own territory, is completely false. Like, they may be protesting, but they're not protesters. They are standing in the truth of their laws and our laws that have existed for thousands of years. And the fact that each and every news story that comes out about Wet'suwet'en.
Oh, did we lose Jerome again?
Oh, he's back.
Oh, I can see you in the chat.
I don't know what's going on.
Okay, we got you. Yeah, we can.
Anyway. Okay, I'll try to keep it short here. Yeah, basically, I'm not an activist, and I don't think Wet'suwet'en people on their territory or Tachidat people on their territory are activists. They are making sure that people become aware of where they stand and mm-hmm. how much it is actual, as much law as the statutes in Canada. And in fact, so because they're older and have been in force and have never been extinguished. And as far as objectivity goes, it's, I don't think it's ever existed. A person is writing from the perspective of what's considered a Western belief, then that is also not very objective. It is completely a bubble of existence that doesn't allow for things that have been kept secret for so long. So it's, yeah, take that for what you will.
Yeah, that was, thank you so much. That was such a great reminder, and I can see Deli clapped as well. Yeah, it's just the same. It's a very Eurocentric idea, and a lot of BIPOC communities, Black communities, Indigenous communities have been fighting against the very limiting notion of objectivity because you have to be very privileged to really separate yourself from all the injustices. And also thanks for the reminder on language, where especially in your reporting, Jerome, you used the word land defenders, but a lot of mainstream publications still use the word protesters time and again mm-hmm. when, yeah, like you really summed it up, that they're not protesting. And so, yeah, that's just a very crucial reminder that a lot of people still miss. Yeah, thanks. Thank you for answering that question, everybody. I am going to move on to my next question, which is, I actually do have questions specifically to each of you, because you work in different mediums and have diverse experiences, and I'd be remiss if I don't ask you specific questions about your work. And so I wanted to start with you, Deli. How do you go about the research process when creating content for your Instagram page, What's Within Checkpoint, which has like so many followers?
Generally, I generally make sure that whoever, because I do a lot of like resharing primarily, mm-hmm. which is why it's always been a little bit mind-boggling that the followers, that there are so many followers, but it's generally, you know, who I trust, what I know about them. For a lot of content creators, I've either met them in person through other like various forums, such as I met a number of people when I was at the United Nations. I've met some through labor work. And so just knowing them and knowing what their values and morals are and being able to trust that. There are a lot of content creators that I have, I've seen questionable morals and ethics with, and I won't share from those, which really limits the amount that I can share. And it sucks because, you know, they'll have some great content out, but I don't share anything from rape apologists. I don't share anything from anybody who's allowed for or enabled abuses of any sort. I don't share from people who, you know, don't have transparency or accountability to their communities or their nations. I don't share from, you know, people that are abusive or bully or slander or threaten, that type of stuff. And it does limit it, but I also know then that the people that I am actually sharing from are good people, and they, you know, they mean well, they know. And I think that it's really important that, you know, everybody does that in the accounts that they follow, the media outlets that they follow, that they make sure that they know who the people are.
Definitely. Yeah, thank you. And even in journalism, being cognizant of who you're interviewing and what their values are, because ethics and like morality really goes hand in hand, and people try to debate that it's separate. And so yeah, that's again a really good reminder to keep those things, keep those values going, and not platforming folks that are not ethical or are sketchy. Thanks Deli for that. Nicholas, I wanted to ask you, I know you've done quite a lot of work advocating and writing about the opioid overdose crisis in the downtown east side. So I'm curious if you see any parallels between doing that and advocating and writing about that opioid crisis and also like talking about indigenous issues.
Indigenous issues are indigenous issues, and the opioid crisis is the opioid crisis. Lots of indigenous people are affected by it, but it depends on the publication, really. If I'm speaking to, you know, in an indigenous media outlet like the Turtle Island Journal of Indigenous Health, my context for that writing is based in indigenous ideas, whereas if I'm writing about downtown east side or the overdose crisis or whatever, my context is set there. And the overdose crisis, I wouldn't want to bring any sort of indigenous over generalizing context to it, because it affects so many people, right?
For sure.
And it can affect anybody. Anybody can die of an overdose, but not anybody can be indigenous, right? So if I'm in that context, that I'm representing like my community and my people in a different way. You know, they're both sort of their own special context, I guess, but you know, acknowledging them both is the idea, and representing the voice as I see it would be, you know, proper to do that.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I guess what I was more curious to know, which I could have framed the question better, was the challenges of doing those kind of, I mean, I don't know if you call them your beats, but I know you've done a lot of work in writing about the opioid crisis, and then you also talk about Indigenous issues. So what are kind of some of the challenges you come across? And I know we chatted a little bit about like the extractive research and journalism practices, if you wanted to talk a bit about that.
Yeah, I guess there's, I haven't really done too much on the opioid crisis, really. There's the one article in Megaphone that was about isolated into overdose, it was called. And that was sort of a longer piece, but it's mostly like expository essay style writing. I haven't done a lot of interviews. When I went to Langara for a course this summer called Fundamentals of Reporting, and that's basically my first training in journalism. Like, really, I don't really consider myself a media person as per se. but the challenges I find are, I guess, just challenging the status quo around either of those issues. Trying to keep it a positive spin, finding hope and whatnot, and really trying to raise people up about issues that they that not a lot of people have any context for in their mind, or that they understand completely yet. You know, we're just in the first generation of truth and reconciliation. People are still kind of have a lot of deeply ingrained attitudes about drugs and about Native people. And we're just starting to be able to look at those issues and stuff. So I'm mostly just trying to be gentle, right? Trying to be gentle and calm when I share or whatever. It can be a challenge because you want to be, you know, with Indigenous issues, you want to be mad with people stigmatizing your community and your personal use of what you do with your own body. Of course, you want to get mad if you're being judged about it and not heard, right? All these people are so such good people, right, around downtown Eastside, that but to stand up for them and see so much you know, hate for them is can be, you know, difficult at times. I'm just very grateful to have the voice at all, really.
Yeah, thank you for sharing your experience. And yeah, it's very infuriating how a lot of things we see happen like time and again, sort of the same stereotypes being perpetuated. I will move on to my question for Jerome. And I think we talked about it a bit about language and what you're talking about, Jerome, land defenders versus protesters, and how I was seeing a lot of debate in media about that. And so and I'm curious if you can shed a bit of light about how do you navigate sort of the nuances of language when reporting?
I just basically navigate it with facts. I don't, from my perspective, which is in a lot of ways a place of privilege too. I was privileged to be raised by my grandparents and taught a lot of our culture as much as they could teach me in the short time they were here. And I just make sure that everything that I share is accurate, and the use of language, the differences of using protester or activist or land defender is hugely impactful. And like Delise said earlier, that is in a lot of ways intentional. Those things are intentional. Those misuse of language when talking about resource extraction and theft from Indigenous lands. It really frames a person's idea of what is who are the bad people, and a lot of what gets missed in that language and back and forth is the complete lack of pointing out how much violence and permissive violence is brought by the police. There's never, in a lot of like legacy media, there's not any, whenever they mention violence, it's never coming from police. The violence is a product of the people standing up, the people at Fairy Creek, the Wet'suwet'en, the Gitxsan chiefs. It's not, yeah, so it in a lot of ways is like I just deal with it like pointing out what is, and when I experience it as a journalist, like one of the most protected profession in our Canadian charter, when even I experience it when I'm out there doing my job, I make sure that people learn the things that I've been made aware of, you know, through language.
Yeah, no, thank you so much. That was great. And language, yeah, can be, is very powerful, of course, and can be very, can serve us, but also be very harmful. And yeah, it's very intentional what happens, like what language people decide to use and not listen to the community. I would also like to ask you about this, Deli, and like your thoughts around language and what you kind of experience with like how it's used out there in the mainstream media.
Well, yeah, I mean, I saw it a lot, even with Land Defender and Water Protector. I find that those just get like, they've become just kind of catchphrases, it seems like, right? Like people really want to put titles on something when it's like Jerome said, it's people like upholding our traditional systems and, you know, inhabiting the lands that we've inhabited for tens of thousands of years. It's not, you know, we're just doing what we're supposed to be doing. And a big part of that, I find with language, with that coining those terms, it takes away from the human aspect of things. And it gives like this very, you know, pan-Indigenous view and doesn't take into consideration the fact that we all have very different systems and we all have obligations within our communities and our nations, you know, to uphold those systems. And it's not a one-size-fits-all, you know, term that we can, or that can be used for Indigenous people. And it's frustrating. It's frustrating because, like I said, I just find it incredibly dehumanizing when there are terms that are used for Indigenous people. You know, somebody pointed out, they said, you know, you shouldn't even really use Indigenous when you're talking about like specific groups. And so I found it, I still find it really difficult. You know, sometimes when I write, I'm like, oh, like I should write about, you know, or I should use that nation's name, but then I'm like, oh, it applies to this nation mm-hmm. as well. And so it's a tough, you know, area to navigate, but it's important. And when people talk about truth and reconciliation, which I'm like, I don't know that I necessarily believe in that, but that truth part, a big part of the truth is language that's used. And, you know, we understand like Indigenous people, or I know from my personal experience, I understand the importance of language because we come from oral history, mm-hmm. you know, and that's how our laws have been passed down, and everything in our language is very deliberate and very accurate. So the language portion, you know, it's tough for me, but it means a lot.
Yeah, no, that was great. Thank you. Yeah, language matters and it should really be emphasized. And I don't know, I feel like it's not talked about enough. And yeah, thank you for pointing out the very pan-Indigenous view of, I don't know, cookie cutter approach, right? And I'm curious, Nicholas, if you have anything to add to the very broad topic of language. You're muted.
Sorry. I was raised not around my, you know, native cultures. I was raised by suburbanite white people, fairly good white people that raised me. So I didn't, I didn't really have any training in writing. I just happened to be good at it. But a lot of native people,
you should post the link
sometimes
again.
Don't trust writing. We're just sort of getting, I think, as a, you know, getting to learn what it means to be able to trust the English language a little bit. And, you know, whole generation of kids now are really smart, and some great writers out there nowadays. But yeah, being writing in English in the Western mind can be challenging. You know, words mean different things, and it's hard to nail down what you want to say. And then, like the research issue, all this research is done, academic research and whatnot, but to like bring it back to the people and have it explained in plain language is we're way behind in that, right? That's where the lived experience and engagement comes from, is to be able to communicate, right? So mostly it's more about listening really than it is, I think, about talking. It's what we hear as opposed to what we say.
Absolutely. Yeah, active listening, something which, I don't know, doesn't, I guess, we could all learn more of. For the next question, and this is something that I want to pose to all of you, here at CADR, which is a campus and community radio station, we work with a lot of young volunteers, aspiring journalists, folks that want to work in media, writers, and what are some of the tips that you can give, especially when telling stories about Indigenous peoples and communities?
I'll go.
Yeah.
Just to trust yourself. You're, like I was told in when I was graduating journalism school, we're very fresh and we're very practiced. I went to journalism school at Langara, and it was one of the most difficult things that I've ever done in my life. They prepared us mainly for print, but they do some good work in radio and television also. But just when you're done journalism school and you still want to be a journalist, because that's not always the case, just trust yourself and make sure that you develop a specialty. But one of the things that's missing these days is beat reporting. And I think in a lot of ways that is where a lot of things are lost in the mix, is people are spread out through every topic, they're just assigned because they're the person that's in the room. And a lot of newsrooms are a fraction of what they were when I graduated. So yeah, just understand that when you're graduating, you have a lot to learn still, but you should trust yourself and your instincts, and the training that you went through is still very fresh, so use it.
That's great. Thank you. Yeah, that's something I was someone told me as well, of like just developing your beat, even if it's not like a requirement by the newsroom, just because then instead of doing everything poorly, you're doing one thing not that badly. No, that's a really good point. Thank you. And Nicholas, if you have any tips.
I'm just, like I said, I'm new at this, so I'm not going to claim to give advice about anything. But I agree with Jerome that we should just trust ourselves with our stories about our people, that they're valid and whatnot, and that they deserve to be told, that we have a right to tell them that it's been a long time coming, and that the rest of Canada is in a very sort of fragile place right now, where they, you know, they're just sort of waking up to the realities of the history and whatnot, and just to be gentle with them, in understanding that a lot of them just don't know what went on with us, right? And that a lot of it is very disturbing, and that it's hard to talk about, and that we'll get through it, right? That media is really only like a fleeting thing, right? The news comes and it goes. And so just be able to trust yourself in that moment that your story is worth it, right? And not get discouraged by things like Twitter, I guess, where the attention span for reading is down to like 180 characters or whatever, right? For a reporter, that must be horribly torturing. But I guess we'll just go with the times, right? If you want to tell stories, you tell them.
Mm-hmm. And Deli.
I'll go off of what they said. It's not just, I believe, trust yourself, but speak from the heart, like always, like Nicholas was talking about. And I think it's if it's Indigenous people getting into media, then yeah, like tell your stories and speak from the heart, speak honestly, because I know I've started to see a lot. I mean, there are a lot of content creators that are coming out now that are, you know, considered kind of media outlets. And sometimes I'll message and be like, you know, who are you? Or, you know, what's your story? And some people, we're seeing it a lot with Pretendians, right? I mean, there are a lot of people that are speaking on Indigenous issues or reporting on Indigenous issues when they have like one, you know, way far off ancestor or really like no connections and no connection to Indigenous communities. So not just speak from the heart, but make sure that you are connected to the community that you are speaking from, if you're speaking about a specific community, and hearing their voices. We had people out on our territories that were there for like, the one guy was there for, I think, 9 months off and on, and had never once been to our main community. And I was like, how are you? You can't do, you know, you can't accurately report on people if you are not connected to them. If you're connected to one or two people, those one or two people don't, they are not the be all end all of that nation. Like, you have to make sure that you have some sort of connection and some sort of, you know, ability to hear more than just one voice. So I think, yeah, speaking from the heart and remaining connected and honest, you know, it's the honesty part is incredibly important.
And yeah, just an extension of that, non-Indigenous journalists have such a big responsibility when it comes to reporting on Indigenous issues, and it's been, and media has caused a lot of harm in the past to Indigenous communities. And so I wonder if you folks have any tips for non-Indigenous journalists who are trying to do better and not kind of follow the footsteps in the past when reporting was very harmful and perpetuated stereotypes.
Well, if they're working for like a legacy media or like a daily or weekly newspaper, then they basically have to start with letting their newsroom know that it's going to take time to get a story, because it's coming from a place of little to no knowledge about the community you're about to report on, even though pretty much every story about Indigenous people is going to be super important, and it is super important. Like, you have to take that time, you have to let the newsroom know, and this is a lot of the reason why a lot of Indigenous stories don't make it to print or don't make it to air or on the radio. It's, yeah, just making sure they have the connections, like Delia was saying, mm-hmm. to the community, to different people in the community. Because there's lots of different perspectives. And
any questions?
But starting with that base knowledge, if you're talking about a resource extraction.
I can just start with the burnout question then.
Event like CGL, you have to understand that the territory is unceded, and the Wet'suwet'en have opposed all pipelines for over a decade. So the fact that it has been allowed to get to this point where people are like, well, the community is divided. It's been Wet'suwet'en law for more than 10 years that pipelines aren't allowed on the territory. And how it got to that point was various levels of government and kind of circumventing the BC government's responsibilities. So like that, getting to that point of knowledge takes a lot of time. It takes building trust in the community that you're going to report for. So yeah, I would just say to non-Indigenous people, make sure you know what you're talking about.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the building trust is so, so important that sometimes, I don't know, or like kind of skip over that. And it's like, you have to take time and give time, like you said. And again, pass it on to you, Nicholas and Deli, if you have anything to add to that.
Go ahead, Dila.
Oh, sorry. Well, yeah, I think that it's the background research, and like I said, like being connected and kind of understanding the intricacies. Like, I have a lot of people that like to be in my DMs telling me what I should or shouldn't be saying. And I guess I shouldn't say a lot. There are a handful, and I'm sure I've blocked the rest, but people not having any idea, or like, I guess, non-Indigenous journalists going into an area and not understanding the very like complex relationships and not understanding the basic. When I think of like our territories, you know, some of the reporters that had originally come out in 2019, in just talking to them, some of them lived in our territories and had no idea about anything. And so, like Jerome said, I mean, just doing that background research, but also understanding that, you know, not everybody, you know, falls under the exact same ideas. We're all still individuals. And I think of being back east, and Garnet Goa, like the Great Law of Peace, talks about how people are autonomous and of free will. And that is pushed over and over again. And it's like, I think that having that understanding that we all have the ability to make our decisions, you know, and at the same time respect relationships that we have with other people is a really important part of journalists, you know, reporting on Indigenous issues.
Yeah, thank you for, again, pointing out the intricacies, and which, again, parish food journalism does not exist. And we've talked about this, how extractive it can be. And sometimes I see a lot of legacy media is even reporting on several BIPOC communities of trying to fit them in this Western mold. And it's like, no, it's different. Nicholas, I'll pass it on to you.
Yeah. I guess when you asked me about reporting on Indigenous issues, I went on Google and just entered that term, reporting on Indigenous issues, and there happens to be a website called Reporting on Indigenous Issues. reporting in Indigenous communities, actually, I think it's called. And they've got a whole guide there that sort of breaks down how to deal with stereotypes. And most of it talks about avoiding the tendency to go for conflict and negative content with your stories as being productive for Native people. It's we don't want to write always about or tell always about the negative stuff, right? There's so much positive going on nowadays. It's not that hard. It's almost easier to find a positive story about our people than it is a negative one sometimes. But those issues are real. Same with the downtown east side or whatever. If you're talking about these communities of marginalized people and stuff, that's sensitive material. And you want to make sure you have, informed consent to be talking about it, that you know what you're talking about, that you're showing respect to elders and children and things like this, that people have families and stuff, right? And then so you take that all pretty seriously as a journalist. That's the idea, is be responsible for what you say, right?
Yeah, that's fantastic. Informed consent is again a practice that we really need to be taking seriously, and remembering that not everybody has media literacy and folks know where this is going to go, and ongoing consent. And I will just read what Deli wrote in the chat: trauma porn is not always necessary. And I totally agree. Thanks for mentioning that guide, Reporting in Indigenous Communities, Nicholas. It's by Duncan McHugh, who's an Anishinaabe journalist. I think he's based out of Toronto, and it's a really great guide. I definitely recommend folks having a look at it. And it's time for audience Q&A. I would urge everybody to ask their burning questions in Slido. And I'm just going to take a minute and see what questions we have right now. But please, if you haven't, put your questions in Slido. The link is in the chat. Okay. So,
yes.
Okay. Can we go? Okay. Okay. So I do see one question right here. It says, there is so much burnout in journalism and media and activism. What's been your experience like with burnout, and how do you take care of yourself?
I can go on that.
Please.
I've been doing like downtown east side for 15 years now, and the last six of it doing overdose response pretty much all the time, constantly. It's on my mind and in my consciousness to be watching out for people or trying to process death or grief or whatever. Those get exhausting. And then you add in the fighting stigma against drug users, yeah. Against, research exhaustion and exploitation and stuff. And I put a lot of stuff on myself, is what it is. And so taking care of myself has not always look like what it should look like. When you're allowed, when you're a peer in the community, you're a drug user and whatnot, a lot of times you're allowed to be using and stuff. So mm-hmm. And like kind of hard to stop to like get out of that part of it. But more than that, it's just I get tired from seeing other people's loss, man, seeing my friends and my coworkers having to deal with so much grief all the time, mm-hmm. right? And so I have unlimited amounts of energy, apparently. So I try to put as much as I can into amplifying those voices, mm-hmm. for people, asking questions in the question is my section in the magazine, and the question is that are relevant and will give, understanding and give somebody a chance to speak for themselves, right? Whereas before they might not have had a chance for that.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to
self-care.
Go next? Jerome, please go ahead.
Yeah, self-care is, I think, a lot of people that get involved in journalism,
we can also under-
especially in the last 2 years, it's been something that is difficult to get to. Like, there was a 24-hour news cycle before COVID, but once COVID hit and people were at home generally, I think it became everybody working all the time. And especially with Twitter and Instagram and everything, like there was no time off, basically. And I don't work in journalism full time a lot of the time, but I work in film a lot too. So I go from these essentially conflict zones where police are bringing violence to people standing up for trees, land, water, and going to a very high stress film set. And there wasn't a lot of time for self-care, to be honest. I just needed to take time off. So that's kind of what I'm doing in a lot of ways right now. But I encourage people to, if you can, find a place to disconnect from the job, disconnect from the cycle of constant I started actually hope scrolling. I know people doom scroll, like they're looking for like the worst of the worst, and somehow that's more attractive, but just looking for things online, because that was my access to people at the time, just looking for those good stories, those people sharing what makes them happy, I guess. Yeah, so not a whole heck of a lot, but it was something.
I love that. I'm imagining cat videos when you said hope scrolling. Yeah, that's awesome. You should coin that term. I haven't heard it. We need that. And Deli, I'll pass this question on to you now.
I always say, like, oh yeah, the beginning of my no sleep started like at the inception of the one camp at 44. But when I think about, you know, the work that I've been involved in the past, over the past decade, especially with the advocacy of our missing and murdered loved ones, it's been like 10, over a decade, it's been probably 12 years of like pretty consistent activism, advocacy work. And it just kind of escalated, I guess, during the, you know, the colonial invasion of our territories via corporations and, you know, militarized forces. And during all of that time, I was trying to navigate relationships and advocate for sexual assault survivors and, you know, still keep up the page. And it was a lot. So I experienced some fairly major burnout. But having been a labor advocate for over a decade, I was already, you know, getting very little sleep. I held positions, six different positions with my national local union. And so, you know, they say trauma and stress are an addiction as well, right? And so I think that I had become very much addicted to it. It was that trauma and chaos and stress, and I didn't really take much time to relax until sort of just recently, when I got COVID like a month and a bit ago, and I had to take time off afterwards. The fatigue was, you know, too much, and the stuff started coming out about, you know, like assailants, people who had sexually assaulted other people. And it just became this, like, this storm that was just too much and, you know, very, very fatiguing. And so I didn't have any option but to just kind of shut things down a little bit. And I don't know about self-care. I'm trying, I'm doing my best to, you know, somewhat have self-care. I had points. I used to work a lot on the road. So I had to come to Prince George for a medical appointment, and I ended up booking like two extra nights, and I literally just laid in a hotel room bed and ate like a bag of popcorn for 2 days and watched Netflix on nonstop, which I don't get to do when I'm at home. When I'm at home, I have responsibilities. I have, you know, I have to help people out, and I have to attend feasts and funerals, and I have so much more to attend to. And I feel the obligation to, you know, continue the upkeep on the page. So this is my self-care right now, eating this like omelet burrito combination with like popcorn and crappy Netflix shows. That's it. That's my self-care. Horrible, but.
No, that's awesome. I would disagree. It's not horrible. I love the popcorn, Netflix and chill because I love to do that as well. And I think it has its place. I think this might be all the time we have for questions before we close. Trish has a few words to say.
Yeah, I just had time to sit back and listen to this conversation, and it was really insightful, and I feel like it was so nice to hear everybody's experiences and the advice that they had. And especially because I work in the news collective, it's really nice to get some pointers on how to cover Indigenous issues carefully and with empathy and contextualizing everything, that and never miss those points again. But yeah, thank you so much for answering all the questions and your time, and for sharing your experiences. I learned a lot and Hannah learned a lot, and yes, I'm sure our audience also learned a lot as well. I don't know if
add one thing?
Sure, go ahead.
Just like back to the advice to journalism students, but also journalism professionals.
Please, if you have any final thoughts.
It's become it's become increasingly common for police to create exclusion zones. And my advice to every journalist that is out there is just to ignore them. We're not there to impede in the police's job, and the police should not impede in ours. It happened at Ferry Creek when they first set up an exclusion zone. I just ignored it and went wherever I wanted. And by the third, basically, barrier that the people that were protesting there had set up, every journalist had started ignoring the police and telling us where we could stand and what we could do or what couldn't do. And it's important. It's probably one of the most important things to me as a journalist that is happening right now. And because these clashes aren't gonna go away. So just not be disrespectful either. Like, just say like you're like the rationale they used with me whenever I would just push against them and say, no, you can't do that, you can't tell me what to do, is they're doing it for my safety. And I'm saying, my safety is not your job here. Your job is to, I don't know, it's vague. It's as vague as possible so that they can do whatever they want. And as a journalist reporting on something that is of massive public concern, they should not be able to tell us what to do or where to stand.
Yeah, thanks for that excellent insight. And yeah, I just want to ask if you folks have any final thoughts before we wrap up this panel.
Nicholas,
you're muted again.
Sorry.
No, that's okay.
I would just like to see some more exposure, I guess. You're going to pick an Indigenous issue to talk about. The 60 Scoop litigation is pretty interesting stuff. I mean, we've got really, among all the lawsuits and that were settled out of court and class actions and stuff, I mean, those are huge issues and stuff. Just that how the government, I don't know what you know about this, but like a lot of 60 Scoopers are getting shafted on this deal or whatever, right? A lot of us don't even believe in the money or anything. Just like the closer you can, the more exposure you can bring will put pressure on the government or whatever, just to like do what they said they were going to do, etc. I mean, that affects people, and that money can you know help a lot of people. It'll probably cause a lot of danger too. That's like a compromise they're going to have to look at, right? But yeah, that's going to probably be my next story.
Thank you. Yeah, that's great and very important, of course. And if you have any final words, Deli?
Not in particular. I think just like Nicholas and I are in the community capacity building program with SFU, and I'm incredibly grateful to have such an amazing cohort. You know, all these really impressive people. I keep on saying, like, I have no idea of how I ended up there. I have no idea of how I ended up anywhere, like top 26, the United Nations. Like, I'm like, how did I get here? This is bizarre. But it's, you know, when I think about those instances and that course in particular, I think a lot about how important it is that we build a community and that we continue to have these like really good relationships and continue to form relationships between different communities, because getting out like this information, you know, being able to disseminate really important information like Nicholas was talking about with 60 Scoop and like Jerome was talking about, you know, with ensuring that reporters' rights are respected and protected. I want to be able to know more about these things and what's important, what's happening right then. So I think it's, I just really push, you know, for people really getting to know each other, not just getting to know, you know, a platform or somebody as a journalist, but who people are like as people, where they come from, what their story is, like, because it brings that connection again, right? So I really appreciate you all setting this up and, you know, having us here and inviting me again. I'm like, I don't know how I got invited, but ended up here and I'm very appreciative. So.
Yeah. Right. Thank you. Well, what you said is it's a beautiful note to end on. And just listening to you and all of you, Nicholas, Jerome, Deli, I got such a strong sense of community and solidarity, which really moves away from this individualistic notion and like hustle culture of getting the news first. Like, we're all in this together. And yeah, I'm not really an optimistic person, but we are all in this together. And it's just been such a pleasure. And I'm really honored to have you all. And I could go on. I know, Trish.
Yeah.
And I could go on for another hour. But I would, again, like to thank our great audience, our listeners. It's such a nice day outside, but people are here on Zoom. And I'm very appreciative of that. And of course, to our fantastic panelists for this enriching conversation. I took a lot away from it. You can find these folks online and they're lovely and very approachable. You can find this panel on CADR.ca by searching the show Against the Current. And that's it for me. Have a great evening, everybody. Do you have anything else, Trish?
Thank you.
Yeah, no, just a final thank you to the panelists.
Say it's nice to be outside. I'm out of here.
It is nice outside, so enjoy whatever what time we have before sunset. But yeah. I'm seeing a lot of thank yous in the chat.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Happy Masai.
Thank you.
Then you said.
Yeah, I'm listening.